I have been preaching to Unitarian Universalists now for more than 44 years. One of the definitions of mental illness is doing the same thing over and over again with no appreciable effect. So I thank you, Peter, for giving me one more opportunity to prove my sanity. Because this is no doubt the last time I will preach to this many Unitarian Universalists at one time, I've decided to tell you in the next 20 minutes everything I know. Now, what I know may not impress you as it did not impress the woman at Pepperdine University who approached me after a lecture some years ago to say, "Dr. Schulz, I couldn't hear a word you said tonight." And thinking to be modest, I replied, "Well, you're probably not missing much." To which the woman responded, "Yes, I know, that's what everybody told me." Well, it was Pepperdine after all. Nonetheless, I am going to tell you, if not everything I know, then at least the most important things I know. The problem is that the most important things I know are not original to me. A fellow named Immanuel Kant summed them up 225 years ago in the only penetrable sentence he ever wrote. "Two things fill me with ever new and increasing awe," Kant said, "the starry heavens above and the moral law within." I went into the ministry for two fundamental reasons. The first is because I noticed that my parents listened with rapt attention to everything the minister said on Sunday and thought ministers were very, very wise. For an only child who lived in a world of adults and occasionally struggled to be heard, this made the ministry a very appealing profession. Right now, all of you are making this old man very, very happy. As I tell my students when I teach them preaching, don't worry about people glancing at their watches when you preach. You only have to be concerned when they start shaking them at their ears. And the second reason I went into the ministry was because I knew that everything I cherished would someday pass away, that everyone I loved, all those adults who populated the world around me, would die. And it broke my heart when indeed they did. I was not so naive as to think that by becoming a minister I could ease that hard thing. Had I thought that, I would have chosen a faith other than Unitarian Universalism. But I wanted to live intimately with it, to not run from it, to accompany others into its presence, to relieve what suffering I could, and to finally make peace with our sojourn. That strategy has not worked, at least not perfectly. I have never become reconciled to the dying. It continues to break my heart. But what the religious life has forced me to do is to look to the farthest reaches of those starry heavens and the murkiest depths of that moral law within, and to ask myself what the connection between the two of them might be. The first of those impulses to contemplate the heavens is not limited, of course, to religious people. One of my favorite New Yorker cartoons shows a man and a woman, their arms around each other, their dog at their side, peering up at a starry night The woman turns to the man. "I'm not religious," she says. "I'm just scared." "Well, I am too. But that hasn't kept me nor Kant nor every one of you from periodically staring into the sparkling heavens at night and trying to grasp the immensity of creation, the size and grandeur, the breadth and wonder of the cosmos, of being itself. Because I can't possibly convey to you in words the magnitude of all creation, we are going on a journey. In the next 3.5 minutes, we are going to travel from our beloved earthly home to the farthest limits of the known universe and back again to the very building blocks of life. And as we do, I simply want you to pay attention to what you feel." Thou hast made us to taste of the wine of astonishment, says the psalmist. And remember, what you've seen is only the known universe. You and I do not need to understand quasars or black holes or string theory or cosmic inflation to be stunned into silence by the majesty of being itself. To set ourselves within the context of what we just saw is to understand on one level that everything that happens here on earth, war, joy, passion, death, is in the great cosmic scheme of things pretty trivial. Joan Rivers said, "I knew I was an unwanted baby when I saw that my bath toys were a toaster and a radio." Take one look at this video, Joan, and forget about it. Every single one of us is but a brief upsurge of organized consciousness flitting through the cosmos for a millifraction of a second. Insignificant as we each be, however, every single one of us, and indeed the very earth itself, is held tight in the embrace of creation. We came from it, we will return to it, dust to dust, ashes to ashes. Energy is never created or destroyed, it just changes form. As the great poet Elder Olson put it, nothing is lost. Time, like the sea, gives back all in the end, but only in its own way. Empires as grains of sand, mountains as pebbles. Be still, I say. You were never the water, only the wave. We are, each one of us, held in the embrace of creation. Ponder this thing in your heart. Ponder with awe. This is the wonder of time. This is the marvel of space. Out of the stars swung the earth. This is why we are in covenant with creation. But if that is true, why do we feel so frightened? Why do we know exactly what the woman in that cartoon meant when she said, "I'm not religious, I'm just scared"? Well, it is because, though we taste of the wine of astonishment, thou hast also showed thy people hard things. I would be surprised if very many of us could travel as we just did to the far reaches of the universe, and in addition to feeling wonder at the unfathomable, not also feel our vulnerability. To set ourselves within the context of what we just saw is to understand at another level that everything that happens here on earth, war, heartache, joy, passion, death, everything is enormously important because we are so very fragile. A tiny star flying through space, our bodies 90% water, our minds susceptible to demagoguery, our earth the prey of exhaustion, our hearts so prone to break. The father of a child with dwarfism allowed his daughter to undergo painful limb-lengthening surgery. Someone criticized him for it, calling it akin to torture. "I'll tell you what torture is," the father said. "Having arms too short to wipe yourself." Our fragility as human beings, as a human race and as a planet, that's the connection between those starry heavens above and Kant's moral law within. Can anyone truly understand the tiny speck of the universe we human beings occupy and not see in an instant that everything that keeps us isolated from one another, every ideology that divides us, every faith that preaches its superiority over others, every intentional cruelty is stupidity on a truly cosmic scale? Last February, 2 days after the meteor hit Chelyabinsk, Russia, deep in the Ural Mountains, you remember that. 2 days after the meteor hit, I was in a New York City taxi cab when the driver said to me out of nowhere, "You know, I am from Chelyabinsk. My parents still live there." I hope they are okay, I said. Oh, yes, he said, but when the meteor hit, my old father was sitting by the fireplace in his underpants reading, and when it hit, he leapt up to his feet shouting, "It's the Americans! The Americans! They've finally done it!" And he rushed outside in his underpants into the minus 10 degree cold, ignoring my mother's welfare completely and accidentally locking the door behind him. She was so angry that when he started desperately knocking on the door to get back in, she wouldn't open it. "Go ask your friends, the Americans, to help you," was all she shouted. When you are floating through space on a fragile blue boat, you truly do need one another. Spouses need spouses. Americans need Russians. Straight folks need LGBTQI folks. Jews need Muslims. The UUSC needs the UUA, and we all need each blossom of the green and gladsome tree. This is why we are in covenant with each other and the earth. The starry heavens above, the moral law within and their connection with one another, those have been the touchstones of my ministry, as indeed they are of Unitarian Universalism. So what lessons do we draw? These two. First, that because we are all so fragile, our obligation as human beings is to be agents of that moral law, to make glad the hearts that travel with us, and to remind those who would turn drab the promise of justice that everyone will die, that not a one of us wins in the end, and that those who exploit the fragility of the earth or the vulnerability of their neighbors despoil a sacred covenant and betray the precious moment they have been given upon this earth. Martin Luther King Jr. was asked how he managed to prevail against so much power aligned against him, the police, the banks, the businesses, the sheriffs, and he said, "We never let them rest." And that's what the moral law commands us to say to all those who would steal life's promise from the helpless. "We will not stand for that. We'll never let you rest." To those who slaughter without regret, who butcher without remorse, we say, "We are all children of the cosmos, you know. Harm another, and we'll never let you rest." And to those whose greed would make barren the lush plains, whose narrowness of heart tarnish the very luster of humanity, no rest for you. No peace for you, no rest, no peace, no victory. And then there is a second and final lesson we draw, a more gentle one, from the starry heavens above. That because we are so fragile, so unlikely to be here in the first place, such a surprising twist of creation, our wisest sentiment is gratitude, and our smartest strategy is trust. I know it doesn't feel that way when we are in the midst of the maelstrom, when our lives are falling apart around us, when all those beloved ones are dying. I know it doesn't feel that way. Of course it doesn't. Even Leonard Wolfe, the exquisitely rational husband of the novelist Virginia, even for him, the day Virginia Woolf walked into the River Ouse and disappeared, Leonard recorded in his diary the cumulative mileage of his car. The day of her cremation, he went to have his hair cut. but on the page of his diary for the day she died, March 28, 1941, on that page, and that page alone in all his years of neat diary keeping, there is a brownish yellow stain. He had tried to wipe off the page, the evidence of his tears. I know it often doesn't feel this way. I told you that I have never become reconciled to the dying. But the most important thing I know, through all the heartache and the tears, is that in a universe like this, there cannot be anything fundamentally wrong, and that held as we each are in the embrace of creation, at the end of the day, it's all going to be okay. In the ancient world, a poetry contest was held each year, and the third place winner was presented a rose made out of silver. The second place winner, a rose made out of gold. But the first place winner received a real rose, a living rose, that while it was far from perfect and didn't live forever, spoke while it did of art and beauty and passion and power. And who among us, my friends, if we had to choose, who among us would not choose the living rose? The living rose.
We'll join the people at General Assembly in singing hymn number 301. Please rise in body or spirit as soon as we get to that point on the video.